I'm curious, is there any specific practices that you have incorporated or adapted to be more inclusive of transgender individuals? Like in your own, you know, when you go to speak or when you go to talk about scripture or when you go to, and I did start to read a little bit of your book on eunuchs, and I thought that was actually fascinating, the way you shared their stories. But I'm just curious because at least when I was growing up, obviously this wasn't even a topic. And so I'm wondering from your unique perspective and your, like, as a religious leader, when you are talking about the scripture, when you are trying to incorporate transgender people, is there something that you have found that is specific in your teachings that you try to incorporate, I guess?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the most powerful things, that I have found is that stories matter, right? And I've always been a storyteller. And I do a lot of writing that's not theological, right? I'm a playwright. I write for screen. And the reason that I've leaned so hard into stories is because I found that when I go into spaces and I try to like do education, and there is a place for education, right? Like everyone needs a trans 101 workshop and we can do that and that's fine. But when I go into spaces, particularly that might be a little hostile or don't really understand trans folks, what I found is when I went in armed with a bunch of like facts and figures, people wanted to debate, right? They wanted to debate where that came from. They wanted to debate the language. Like it was, and it became this whole thing. But when I went in and I shared my story and I simply said, this is what it was like growing up. This is what I grappled with. This is what I'm doing now. Suddenly the tenor of the conversation, and it happens every time, like just turns on a dime. And there, you know, you'll still get some folks that want to argue. But for the most part, suddenly we're in a space where we're seeing each other. And I become not a problem to be solved, but a person that they have to like grapple with my humanity because they've heard my story. And so I share that to say that much of my work involves this kind of deeply personal storytelling, which is exhausting, but it's also a tactic, right? It's a tactic that works. And so it's why I lean so hard into, we have to tell stories. We have to be able to, and part of this is like, I then do a lot of telling my story in conversation with scripture, because then that opens up a new way for people to both see me, but also it lets them know that, yeah, like I've done my work with the Bible. I know these texts, I know these stories. And also when we can do this work by putting these stories in conversation with one another, suddenly now we have a third space to have a story together. And that becomes then a place where we can really learn and lean into empathy. And that's where I think change starts to happen. So that's kind of a roundabout answer to your question, and is maybe not specific enough, but is the like, that is the kind of tool, is to really lean hard into the telling of personal stories and personal narrative. Because I think it opens up a space to encounter one another in a new way.
Well, that's kind of how they taught us how to evangelize. So if you think about it, you're just giving them a little taste of their own medicine.
Exactly.
You tell your testimony, right? But I want
how to argue with someone's story too.
Right. It's their personal experience.
If you
present
a fact, they can argue with it. But if you're like, this was my own experience, like, what are they going to be like? No, you're wrong. You're lying. No, like, that presents a more deeper sort of conversation than being like, here's a fact.
Right.
So yeah. I think that makes sense.
Well, I do also want to say, though, there are people who will still hear personal stories and experiences and say, no, you're wrong. You're lying.
But I didn't experience that.
Well, yeah. Because like, I'm thinking of all my Black friends, my people of color friends who were like, yeah, this is the experience I went through where I experienced inherent racism. And it was really scary and horrible for me. And a white person will look at them straight in the face and be like, well, I don't believe that happens because my adopted Black child has never experienced that.
Like, the one Black person, you know.
Yeah, it's not full, right? It's not a storytelling is not foolproof.
It's not foolproof.
For sure. And that is, and there are definitely people that will say, you know, will negate your own story. But yeah.
But I also, I wanted to like bring it back. Like when you were talking about advocacy work and being an ally, I'm sorry I didn't respond. My dog was screaming at me and I didn't want Cameron, our editor, to have to deal with that. But I did want to say, like, yes, 100%, I hear you on that. And like, I am just as passionate about that feeling of like, why are you calling yourself an ally when you are literally doing nothing? And you might, maybe you go to Pride and you like to go to gay bars. That's not being an ally. Having a group chat with gay people or queer people is not being an ally. Like, what does being an ally really look like? And we've had this conversation with, you know, Black folks who've come onto the podcast and talked about, you know, like how Christianity is steeped in systemic oppression and white supremacy, and what true work, like anti-white supremacy work, looks like, what true allyship looks like in that area. And so I know we've talked about, like, yes, it's important to get educated on the trans experience, so that when you encounter a trans or non-binary person, you know, you don't have to go and ask them a bunch of deep personal questions about their transition and experience, because that's just like a not fair. Like, maybe keep it on topic of why you're meeting them. Like, maybe keep it in context. Are there other ways that people can show up to be good allies? Ways that are practical, ways that get people really in their communities, like doing work that is true allyship for trans and queer folks, especially folks who are, you know, maybe they're still in a body of faith, or maybe they've recently exited, but they still maintain that belief system. What would that look like to be a true ally of the LGBTQ plus community?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I think that anytime you can help to educate your communities, that is a huge, huge thing and takes the burden off of queer and trans folks to do that education work. Preferably make sure that you know what you're talking about before you educate, and then otherwise it makes it even harder for us. But I do think that, right, like making sure that people are aware of like books and documentaries created by queer and trans folks, like that's an easy way for you to connect with your community and say, have you watched this documentary? I just read this book. I really think you would love it. That helps to start to do the education work. And then, you know, the other thing is to like figure out what people need in your community and start to offer it. Anywhere you are, there are already people that are organizing. Like even in the reddest of red states, there are groups that are organizing that are working to make their community safer. Part of what you might need to do is just start to show up. And often what folks need you to do is like the not sexy work. Right? We need you to help like set up chairs and take down chairs for the meeting. We need you to help bring a fruit plate. We need you to provide space that is free and that's safe for us to have our meetings. Right? And so to show up and to start to just be in a posture of, I don't need to lead. I'm just going to be here. And whatever you need, no matter how mundane it is, like that's what I'm going to do, is like the best way to get involved. And then you start to know people and you start to know, like, what are they facing? What are the concerns in this community? How else might I be able to get involved? And then finally, like, if you are in the US, there is a bill, I can promise you, there is a bill in your state right now that is targeting trans people. So like, figure out what that bill is and start to organize against it. Get your friends, like, make sure that whatever right-wing talking points are being parroted around to drum up fear, that you are countering those with actual information. The fear-mongering that's happening, particularly around trans kids right now, is, like, just out of control. And it's all falsified information, right? Like, no one is medically transitioning children. That is not happening. It's not happening. And so, like, figure out how you can counter these things and organize against these bills. They're happening every day, and there are people fighting them. But, like, we need more people to really do that educational work. And, like, that is a great way to show up and to be an ally and to be in support of the community.
There's also, I remember when, like, BLM took off and all the white people were like, how do we show that we're allies of black people? And the black people were like, please just, like, shop at black owned businesses. Like, that is the most basic of the basic. Like, if you don't want to go to the marches, that's totally cool and fine. Just, like, shop at black owned businesses. And what, something came to mind when you were talking about, like, you know, just like showing up and doing the unsexy work. There is actually a coffee co-op here in where I'm at in Louisville, Kentucky, and it is queer run, and it's a queer friendly space, and it's also a homeless friendly space. And they supply Narcan and condoms, and they have condoms for people with female genitalia, and they have like all different kinds of support available. They have tons of posters and like events that are like fundraising, and like, it's such a cool nonprofit space. And so one of the things that I've started doing in my community is when I go out for coffee with my friends, that's where we go. That's where we put our money. When we want to go to a cool open mic or something, that's where we go. Like, that's where we're frequenting. We're making sure that we're keeping that place packed. Anytime I run into anyone that's queer or trans or, you know, just looking for a safe space, I'm like, have you ever heard of the Louisville Coffee Co-op? Like, you need to go. Like, that's the spot you need to go to. There are super anti-police. Police officers are not even allowed in there. Like, it's a safe space. Like, just go, you know? And so it's such a tiny thing. Like, to me, I don't think that's allyship work. Because I'm used to, like, you know, in my brain, like, you know, being a missionary kid, it's like, you need to be out there doing, like, you know, getting your hands super dirty. No, you don't. You just need to support communities that are already doing that work and just, you know, give them that boost, you know, pass out some of their business cards, let people know that they exist, show up.
And I think that often, right, the impulse becomes, how do I signal to other people that I'm one of the good ones, right? As opposed to, how do I actually show up and be one of the good ones, right? And I think that posture, that shift in posture of like, it doesn't have to be visible. I don't have to get applause for it. I just need to put in the work. It's really, really important. And the last thing I'll say on this too, is that, like, the other piece of this, and I think that this is in solidarity for any marginalized community, when you're trying to be in solidarity with Black and BIPOC folks, with trans folks, with queer folks, is that at some point you're going to get it wrong. You're going to mess up. Like, that is inevitable. And so the question isn't like, if you mess up, it's when you mess up, how do you handle being corrected? And I think that's the hardest thing to learn, is that posture of, just because I messed up doesn't mean that I'm a bad person, but it does mean that I have something to learn and I need to, like, apologize and repair the harm that I've caused and do better next time. And so often folks will mess up and they'll make it like 17 times worse by freaking out about the correction. And it's like, that is the exact wrong thing to do. And so if you can start to practice now how you will respond when you get corrected, and that trust that, like, sometimes a marginalized person is not going to correct you politely, right? Because you've done harm. And that is, if it happens in anger, like, you still have a responsibility to take that in, to correct your behavior, and to do better moving forward.
I mean, that can be just as simple as fucking somebody's pronouns up, which I do all yes. the time without even trying. Like, it's so tough. Like, it's a whole new language and you're learning it. And, like, I'm a queer person. So I'm like, of course I'm your ally. I'm a queer person, but like, I totally fucked your pronouns up and I've been called out and they'll like, just correct, you know, like it's they, them. Oh fuck. They were saying, and I'll repeat whatever I said and use the correct pronouns. And it's just quick and it's not even a like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I totally messed that up. I'll just be, fuck. You're right. They said this and then they're like, thank you. You got like, you're good. Like we're all good, you know? And, but I do think it is important to also recognize that some people might not be as nice and accommodating to those of us who are still learning and figuring it out. And even as a queer person, like I am figuring it out. Like I'm still learning. I have a sibling who's non-binary and they were telling me about something and I had to ask them a very uncomfortable question. And I was like, I'm so sorry. You're going to have to give me a little education around this because I do not know what you're talking about. And I want to be super supportive and understanding, but what does this phrase mean that you just said, you know, and like being okay with not knowing, like that's also really okay.
Yeah. Being okay with not knowing. And I also think in that moment, right? Like there is a world in which your sibling could have said, I don't have the bandwidth to educate you. Right.
Google
now.
It.
And like and being okay with that too, right?
Absolutely.
Like I think that often we have this expectation, well, if I just ask nicely, then I'm entitled to a response. And it's like, well, sometimes the other person just might not have it in them to give you the response that you need. And like you have to be okay with that too.
And that's not a
mean thing, right? No. That is a gift of grace to say, I can't do that right now.
And I think that's for queer people, like to like have that kind of boundary work, like to start working on that boundary work for ourselves so that when folks do present us with a question that we are not comfortable answering or we don't have the bandwidth to answer, just like the energy and capacity to answer it, to be able to straight up tell them, I don't have the capacity to answer that question right now, but you should Google that. Like, I know there's the answers out there. So Google that and then let's circle back to this conversation at another time, you know, and like that's really beautiful boundary work. And I really encourage anyone who is in a space where you are a minority and you're being faced with questions that feel uncomfortable, they feel triggering, they feel ignorant, is to work on that boundary work for yourself, because constantly responding to a trigger in a triggered way, like in that reactive way, is only going to continue to cause you harm. Like we're not saying that, I mean, I'm not saying that you need to be polite to everyone, but knowing when things are out of bounds for you and to be able to say that's out of bounds for me, I'm going to step away from this. That is going to be the most protective work you can do for yourself versus like continually being upset by people being ignorant instead of just saying, hey, that's a little ignorant. I really recommend you go look that up. I can't be the person for you to look that up for, you know, like, so like, for me, like that's where I'm at in my life. Like just like learning how to communicate those boundaries and learning where my boundaries are. And that's been really helpful to me in any kind of relationship scenario.
And I think that for those of us who grew up in evangelicalism or any kind of high control religion that have been taught that we don't have a right to boundaries, right? We don't have a right to boundaries around our body. We don't have a right to boundaries around identities and questions. That learning to do that boundary work is really, really vital. And it's like, and it's going to feel like you're being mean or unloving, but it's actually the most loving thing that you can do to protect yourself, to model for someone else your own agency, and to set limits around how people can interact with you. Like, I think that is really, really vital. It's not just around triggers, like it's around that too, but it's also around like, no, I'm not going to have this conversation with you again about my religious beliefs. I'm not going to talk to you again about going to church on Christmas Eve. Like this, I have set a boundary with you around how I can safely come home to visit, around how I can interact with you. Like, and it is a loving thing to do to help people understand how to love us well. And so I think that like doing that boundary work is so, so vitally important and it's so deeply uncomfortable. And like, learning to set boundaries has been one of the kind of hardest journeys of my life. And also one of the ones that has been the most life-giving and health creating, in the last couple of years.
Recently, I have started prioritizing my health and wellness habits, like exercising, eating better, and hydrating. Sometimes drinking 96 ounces of water a day can be a lot to do. That's why I like to use Liquid IV to give me some help with my hydration goals. With 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, plus 8 vitamins and nutrients for everyday wellness, Liquid IV hydrates 2 times faster than water alone. Plus, you can keep your daily routine exciting with 3 new flavors, white peach, green grape, and lemon lime, so you can switch it up and make your taste buds happy. I like to use it before a workout, when I'm feeling run down, or after a long night out because your girl is too old for hangovers. I love Liquid IV's convenient packaging. It's individual and ready to go, so you can just be your hydrated and fabulous self. I know I feel better when I'm hydrated. And if you're wondering about the sugar, honey, don't. It's sugar-free. There are no artificial sweeteners and zero sugar. With a proprietary amino acid allulose blend for a sweet taste without the calories or raised blood glucose levels you get from sugar. It's non-GMO and free from gluten, dairy, and soy. Get 20% off when you grab your Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier sugar-free or any other variant at liquidiv.com and use code CHEERS at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code CHEERS at liquidiv.com.
Okay, so this the last question we just discussed kind of leads me to this question, if you're up for it, Shannon. Because as someone who grew up in a background of evangelical, and I remember when we talked about gay people, it was like so bad. And like just everything around the subject has been bad. So my brain has definitely built up certain biases around these subjects just automatically that I'm trying to unravel as I deconstruct. So my question is, how do I unravel the biases sort of in my brain when certain subjects come up? Like how do I ask questions and try to understand while acknowledging the experience of gay, trans people? How do I approach that subject while wanting to learn from you, I guess, while also trying to address these constructs in my head, if that makes sense. I they come up so much and it's so hard to be like, that's what that is. And that's what that is, you know, without being like, oh no, this is who I am. This is just what I think. No, I acknowledge that this is just how I was raised. It's so hard. It's so fucking hard.
Yeah, I think this is such a great question because I think that you're right that like we, and this is not just like folks in evangelicalism about LGBTQ folks, right? This is white people living in the US. This is Christians learning about Judaism, right? Like we have been so indoctrinated in these systems. And I think that the first thing is absolutely what you just said, is to realize that that is even happening, right? And so anytime a thought comes up where I'm like, well, Jews believe or black, and it's, that is a moment for me to go, oh, wait a second. That is, no one's a monolith. No community is a monolith. And so if I've started there, I'm already off on the wrong foot. And so I think starting to interrupt those patterns helps us to be aware of where these things are coming up. So that's step one. Step two, I think, is to expose ourselves to the widest variety of stories and voices and experiences as we can. So that we can start to really understand like, oh, there are a lot of ways to be trans, right? There are a lot of ways to be gay. There are a lot of ways to live in this world. And so by like really doing the work to seek out queer and trans media, and particularly media that was like designed and written by trans folks. There's a lot of trans stories out there that were not written by trans people. And so like really like doing the work to dial down of like, okay, it looks like no trans people were involved in this. I'm going to maybe pick something else. But there are so many like great memoirs out now. There's so much more than I had access to. And even like people documenting their transitions on TikTok and YouTube, right? Like, I think the more voices you can hear, the more it helps to then, when a thought comes up, you can be like, oh, but wait a second. I watched this video and this person like shared their story. I think that is a narrative that I got from my church and I don't have to hold on to that anymore. So there's much work that you can do to hear other stories. And then I think, you know, the last part is, as you're building relationships with people, really being aware of when you maybe need to say something and when you shouldn't, right? Being aware of like, oh, this is a time to ask a question, and aware of the time of like, oh no, I think that is a question that I need to take to my journal or to take to a friend who I know is further along on this journey.
Could you give possibly of that?
Yeah.
I just feel like that's such a wide, like for me personally, yeah. I obviously want to be sensitive to that, but I'm trying to.
Well, I have an example. Okay. So I'm polyamorous and that like it comes all sorts of really inappropriate questions, right? When people ask about that. So like if I'm on a date and I've told someone I'm non-monogamous or I'm polyamorous, I'm laying it on the table first and foremost, right? And like kind of leaving it as like, you can ask me questions because we're on a date. That would be a great container to ask me all the questions you have about polyamory. An inappropriate question would be, oh, so does that mean we can have threesomes? Like, you know what I mean? Like there are ways to like ask inappropriate questions and appropriate questions that I found like, okay, like that, maybe that's not the right question to have asked me. And then like, I also feel like sometimes there's points where it's like, you're talking to someone who's different than you, maybe a little bit of an insensitive question, just ignorance pops up in your head. That's a great time to go to Google about it. And then you can Google it and learn something about it. And then maybe if you have a level of trust with that person and you are good friends or you're acquainted on several different levels, maybe it's like, hey, like I was reading this last night and like, what are your thoughts on that? Like, do you have thoughts on that? Is this something that you could relate to your experience? Like being more sensitive in the way you ask, maybe? Like, I don't know, like what kind of questions are coming up for you? Like,
I think when people are asking more about a transgender experience, it's more of a curiosity of,
is it because
you don't think it is?
Not all the time.
For me, I think it is. Invasive. Like I have curiosity questions because it's so, again, if we're going back to evangelicalism, it's so different from anything I learned about gender ever. So generally, when I want to ask a question, I'm more afraid, like when I'm afraid of asking questions, I'm afraid of being called transphobic. Mm. But in reality, what I'm trying to do is understand. And I agree that I definitely catch thoughts that I'm like, I should not ask that question. But I also think that I could ask any question and be called transphobic too in this day and age. Like any question around transgender, I feel like to some extent. So my only mission here is to obviously, I want to deconstruct the biases from being raised. And I obviously want to be respectful of people, but I also want to, I think it should be okay for me to ask questions about someone's life. That's not invasive, obviously. I'm not asking about their sex life. I'm not asking about things like that. I'm just trying to understand them as a person. And I think that because gender is so male, female in the evangelical world, it's so specific that anything outside of it can just be a little bit jarring as we're deconstructing and as we want to learn more. I don't know. Again, I'm trying not to be invasive. I guess I'm just asking, you know, obviously I Google a lot of shit. I watch a lot of documentaries, but I also want to be able to talk to people. I want it to be a personal level of being able to understand people, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a couple of things here. One is that like, sometimes I'm in a space where, so like when I'm doing a trans 101 question or, you know, workshop, I will tell the audience, this is the moment that you can ask any question you want, because I am here in a capacity as an educator. And like mm-hmm. part of my work in that moment might be to say like, that is an inappropriate question and I'm not going to answer sure. it, or I'm yeah. going to answer it like more broadly. Right. So that's one thing, is to like, what is the, where are you, right? Like, are you in a setting where you, where someone is an educator, ask sure. the question.
Yes.
I think it becomes like, what type of relationship do you have with this person? Mm-hmm. Is it someone that you're close to? The people that I'm like close to, I have a much wider, range of questions that I will accept from them, right? Because we're friends. Sure. We have a relationship. Mm-hmm. I talk about my life. So there's that kind of piece. And then there's also the piece of like, how are you asking the question? And I think that this goes back to the question about, you know, if you ask a question and someone says, I don't want to answer that, or I don't have bandwidth to answer that, like, just take that. But I do think asking sure. questions like, I don't, what does that mean for you? Or how, mm-hmm. how,
what is that like for you?
What is that like for you? Like, those are things that I can choose a lot of levels of ways to answer that question, right? Like, mm-hmm. I can be really personal, but I can also, if I'm not feeling like we're in that space, I can answer kind of more vaguely. I remember I was doing this playwrights conference, and I was being housed with people that I didn't know, which is always a little fraught for trans folks. And I was working on this solo performance piece about gender. And so I was really publicly out, which also, we're in a rural community. Like, I just never know how that's going to go. And my host person one night was like, so I read that you're transgender. And I was like, oh, here we go. Like, this is about to get ugly, and it's going to be awful. And then he said, I was just wondering, like, what does that mean to you? And it was such a beautiful moment. It was such a genuine and, like, kind way to ask that question. And it really provided all sorts of ways for me to answer, right? Like, I was able to take that in a lot of different directions. And the gentleness with which he asked it, and I could tell he was kind of nervous to ask the question, which is also why I thought it was, sure. we were about to go way off the rails. But it was just such a beautiful thing. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, this is a moment where I felt really safe to, like, have a conversation because of how the question was asked. And so I think that, like, for me, I will say almost always, I am willing to talk about my experiences, about how it feels, about what it's been. I'm rarely, if ever, willing to talk about my body, right? Unless I'm doing a public performance where I'm talking about my body, which that happens too. But like in a, you know, and I, so I think like thinking about that when you're thinking about questions too, of like, mm-hmm. if this is a question to like get to know someone's experience, what is the broadest and most gentle way that I can ask it that allows them to enter into the answer in a lot of different ways? And then you can kind of suss it out from there, right? And then anything yeah. that's about like body, surgeries, medicine, go to Google.
Yes.
Or do it in a training session, right? Like,
sure. No, I think that makes so much sense. I think you totally answered my question. I think it's just sort of like, because we're so curious as human beings too. Like, we just kind of want to know all the things. But I think how you presented that makes so much sense to me, and hopefully to other people, how to approach the subject.
Yeah, I think you're right too, though, that like trans and non-binary folks have such a gift to offer when it comes to talking about gender, especially to folks that were raised in, and not just evangelical, like we were society, raised in America, yeah. you got weird yeah. stuff about gender, right? Like, yes, so let's figure out how to enter into those conversations. And then I do think like the last thing I would say is like, if you're trying to figure out like, I'm just thinking about all of the misinformation that's happening right now, so especially around trans kids and medicine. Like, I think that there is a way to be like, listen, I read this article. Something about it feels funky to me. Like, can you help me either understand or know where to go? That's the other thing. People asking me, how can I learn on my own? Often I'll just answer the question for them, but knowing that what they've asked for is a resource allows me to say, to either point them toward the resource and not have to feel like I have to answer it. Because I know, like, I know that there's so much crap out there that sometimes people just want to know, like, this has been vetted. I can trust this book. I can trust this website. And I'm much more willing to engage with someone who's like, I'm just like, I'm trying to understand. Can you point me toward the thing? And then I can be like, yes, or here's the answer that you're looking for.
Gotcha.
Coming from a therapist perspective, because I work with humans and bodies every day, and I do have to ask invasive questions and about surgeries and stuff because it's part of my job. I have learned that when you see the person as a whole person, that's their body, their mind, their spirit, their experiences, their happy moments, their traumatic moments, that they're coming in as a whole person. They are not just a trans person. They are not just a gay person. They are not just a Black person. They are not just a white person. They're not just a geriatric person. They are a whole person. It allows for a softness in the way I ask my questions, because I do have to ask certain questions that might be uncomfortable for that person who's like, oh my God, you're a stranger and you're asking me something really, you know, kind of personal, but I see that it's prevalent to the work. But because I'm seeing them as a whole person and I'm like, hey, so, you know, you put down on your paper that you recently had top surgery. How is your recovery going? Can you talk to me about what you're experiencing in your body in this recovery? I actually need to know this for the way I'm going to approach my work today, you know, and being able to like fully see them as a whole person having an experience, not just a trans person who's going to be on my table. It like completely changes the way that I communicate with them. And also in my own experience of being queer and having, you know, like a non-binary sibling and being in spaces that are very queer and gender affirming, we just want to be seen as whole people. And so, you know, maybe when we're at a party and it's like your first time meeting us, that's not necessarily the time to ask deep personal questions because we're not in a deep personal setting. Maybe that's for meeting number two or number three, you know, maybe that's when we're not at, you know, a party where people are drinking and maybe other people can overhear parts of the conversation or come into that conversation. I feel like so many of these like moments where we're wanting to ask super deep personal questions, that needs to be reserved for like private conversations and like maybe a private friendship. Like we have a friendship outside of this situation. Like there is already trust built. You already know that I see you as a whole person. Like that, for me, that's my experience. I would prefer, with my friends, I'm an open book, you know, because I know that they see me as a whole person. So me talking about my gender dysmorphia, like with them, is no big deal. But that's not necessarily something that I would want to talk about at like a party where I'm surrounded by a bunch of people I don't know. And this random person starts talking to me and it's like, oh, I saw on your Instagram that you use she, they. What does that mean to you? Like, dude, I'm Molly. Like, nice to meet you. Like, maybe let's start with introducing ourselves, like, you know, like that's where I'm at with that. And so I have a hard time like with that question because I'm like, why are you even asking these questions? Like, what context would these questions come up? Like, do you even know this person? Like, are you even wanting to be their friend? Like, do you have other ways of relating to them that don't involve the fact that they're just trans and that's different for you? Like, and I'm kind of coming at it from like that point of view where I'm like, maybe see them as a whole person first. And then if it comes up and it's appropriate and there's trust, maybe then you can ask some questions, but I don't know. That's where I'm at with it. Hey, we know that deconstructing religious trauma is hard and can feel heavy when you're doing it on your own. We get it. We're right here with you in this process. The one thing we can always go back to is getting quality therapy with a licensed mental health professional. Thank you to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. BetterHelp is the world's largest leading therapy service, and it's 100% online. With BetterHelp, you can tap into a network of over 25,000 licensed and experienced therapists who can help you with a wide range of issues. To get started, you just answer a few questions about your needs and preferences in therapy.
That way, BetterHelp can match you with the right therapist from their network. Then you can talk to your therapist however you feel comfortable, whether it's via text, chat, phone, or video call. You can message your therapist at any time and schedule live sessions when it's convenient for you. If your therapist isn't the right fit for any reason, you can switch to a new therapist at no additional charge. With BetterHelp, you get the same professionalism and quality you expect from in-office therapy, but with a therapist who is custom picked for you. You'll have more scheduling flexibility at a more affordable price. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/cheers. That's better, HELP.com/cheers. Okay. I have one more question that I would love to get into your playwriting, screenwriting, all of that. I'm so intrigued. So I know you don't have a congregation necessarily, right? And again, I know this is a little bit of an invasive question, but is your acceptance in the priest world as a transgender person? Like, I don't know. My mind is blown every time I think about it. And I think that's wonderful that you are in that space. What is that like for you, I guess?
Yeah, it really depends. There are some spaces where it's like just a non-issue. Right. There are other spaces where it's a big issue, right? It really like kind of depends on the people. I will say that, I think that one of the things that's been really important to me is to be as kind of public and out loud as I can, simply because I didn't have any examples of people growing up, right? Like, and I want to be able to be visible so that kids can see that there is someone that they can grow up into, that there is someone that they can, if they want to be in religious leadership, that is possible for them. And so that, I think also anytime you're public and visible, that brings out haters too. So it really is kind of a mix. I feel like I think that people are also, in general are excited about the fact that I'm doing this work, right? That, the ones that obviously don't think I'm bringing everyone to hell with me, because there are those too. so it is that mix. But I feel grateful to be able to share my story, to be in ministry with people, and to be able to walk with people who are going through hard stuff and trying to figure out what life looks like for them. It's such a gift to be able to be in ministry.
That is so cool. It's cool of you to just be in that position and to vibe and to just sort of be interchangeable and depending on like which group you're in. Like, you're like, this is me, this is what I'm doing, this is my calling. And depending on what group, you're just who you are. And I think that's wonderful. Okay.
Yeah. And I feel like I have some privilege to do that, right? Because, I have a community that really supports me. I'm white. I am, seen as who I am when I walk into spaces. And so that there is a level of privilege and a level of safety that I have. I mean, I always feel like all of that is really conditional, right? Because it's also like I'm walking into spaces and as soon as someone knows I'm trans, I might not be safe anymore. But for the most part, I feel like I have some privilege to be able to do that. And I feel like I need to name that privilege. But it also feels important for me I feel like I spent so much of my life in spaces where I couldn't be all of myself. And I'm very much now like, no, I can't do that anymore. Like, for my own health and sanity, I have to be able to walk into spaces and be all of who I am. Like, that's both how I can be the best priest, but it's also how I can be the best human. And so I'm hoping to model that for people. But it's also like for my own self-preservation, right?
Sure.
So we have like,
I like it.
10-ish, 15 minutes left, and you have a book and we want to hear about that. So can you tell us a little bit about your book, what it's about, where people can find it, and why you decided to write it?
Yeah. So the book is called In the Margins, A Transgender Man's Journey with Scripture. And it's a bit of a weird book in that it's really a hybrid. It's part memoir and it's part retelling of 10 Bible stories from a trans perspective. And I wanted to write this book because so many of the books that exist kind of in the like trans theological space are either like defending why trans people can exist using the Bible, which I think is like really important work. I don't mean to denigrate that work. Or it's like super, super academic, which again, also love that work. But like some of that stuff is, it's real dense. And it's like, if you haven't been in the academy for a really long time, like grappling with that is hard. And so I wanted to write something that took like, of course it's okay to be trans, as like, that was just not even going to be an issue on the table that we were going to talk about. But was like grappling with theology, from a trans perspective. And that was also really, really accessible for folks. Like I didn't want anyone to feel like I had to have gone to seminary or have a master's degree in order to read this book. Like I wanted it to be, really accessible. And I think that, like, again, back to the conversation that we had around storytelling, my story was the way in for me of like, I'm just going to tell my story and I'm going to tell how these Bible passages, these stories in the Bible, both like helped me to reflect on my own story differently, but also how my story helped me to read the stories in the Bible differently. And then hopefully also create a third space where the reader, whoever they may be, can encounter their own story in a different way because they've encountered my story and this story from the Bible. So it's stories from both the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. And each chapter is kind of a retelling of a portion of my own life and then enters into the Bible story and then invites us to think differently together about how we understand things like sexual scandal and being outside of the binaries and the wilderness and crucifixion and resurrection and bodies, all of these things.
Yeah, I downloaded Audible because in preparation for this, and I'm only in the second episode, but I remember texting Molly and I was like, Shannon is an incredible writer because it just, the way that you wrote it, and I know I was listening to you, but that was actually also a plus just to hear you reading it to me in the car. I was like, wow, this is very understandable. It's, you know, you're talking about Bible stories we know, and you're reimagining them and you're putting your story in the middle of it. And I thought it was super easy to read. I'm putting quotation marks up and to understand. And I plan on finishing it. I loved it so much so far. And I think you're an incredible writer, and the way that you're just presenting it. And I think everyone should go and either download it or read it. But I think what you did with the book was really well done. Just really well done.
Thank you. It was really fun to write, and it's been fun to share it with folks. And yeah, I did read the audiobook. And so if you want my voice reading it to you.
If you want to hear Shannon read to you.
On Audible.
You do have soothing tones to your voice.
Oh, that's good. And it's fun to like hear the author actually read to you to some extent. I think it's
fun. Was such a weird experience to record it. So I'm glad that it translates. Yeah, because I'm used to preaching. And so when you preach, there is a rhythm to it.
Sure.
And when you read an audiobook, you are not allowed to do that preaching rhythm. No. So it was very much like I had to fight against my own tendencies to keep it steady. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I like it. It's well done. So
thank you.
Download it so Shannon can read it to you.
Shannon, did you have to like go to a recording studio and record it, or did you record it at home? What was that process like? I'm just curious about that.
No, I went to a recording studio in Tulsa. I live in rural Kansas, and Tulsa is the closest big city in Oklahoma. And it was actually really cool because it was a recording studio in an old church that a musician had bought, and like rock bands record there. And so then the publisher rented a little booth for me, which is great. So I went for 3 days and was there about 4 or 5 hours a day, pretty much steadily. Just reading. So it was kind of a wild experience, but it was good. I was glad to have been able to read it because it felt, I don't know, it's such a personal book that to have someone else have read the audiobook, I think would have felt weird for me as a writer. So I was really glad that they were like, no, you should read your own book. I was like, fantastic. So it was good.
Go ahead, Rachel. I was going to ask more questions about the reading of the book, but whatever.
Okay. I just, since we don't have a ton of time left, I want to move into your playwright and screenwrite stuff that you do. So when did you get into that? And what can you just tell our listeners what you write about, what your sort of, I guess, inspiration comes from? Is it about your own personal journey? Is it about your own sort of passions or story? Or is it fiction? Do you come up with things and you're like, I'm going to write about this? Or can you just tell us a little bit about that part of your life? Because that is so fascinating to me.
Yeah. Yeah. So I originally started kind of writing, I would say, kind of short skits when I was in high school. And again, like, awful and religious propaganda.
Sure.
But then I started writing full-length plays when I was in college because I went to college hoping to act. And in this evangelical college, every play that they did was like a murder mystery from the 1940s, right? And I was this genderqueer kid, and they just couldn't figure out how to cast me in anything. And so finally, I was like, well, what if I just wrote something? Would you let me do it? And they said, yeah, go ahead. And so I ended up writing two full-length plays in college, basically as a way to be able to act. And they were like not good. One of them I had seen and gotten obsessed with Rent. And so it's like a Christian Rent with no music and no gay people. So you can imagine like how not good these were. But what I realized in the process of writing these stories is that I was allowed to ask questions in fiction in a way that I wasn't allowed to ask in real life. So I was like, oh, there's something here, like we can grapple differently. And I also saw the reaction of the student body. It was so different to the place that I was writing than it was to the reaction that they were having to, you know, the 1930s murder mystery. And I was like, oh, there's something happening when we all get together in this room and have an encounter that feels emotionally true, that feels really exciting to me. So then I took a bunch of years off to, you know, get jobs and pay the bills. And about 8 years ago, started writing again and realized that was just my passion of telling stories and being able to be in community with people. There's something really powerful about live theater and being in a room together.
Oh my God, preach.
That like,
preach.
It makes a difference, right? Mm-hmm. And so my stories are a combination. I feel like, I don't know, I'll speak for myself. I feel like I show up in all of the things that I write, mm-hmm. even if it's not about me, right? Like I'm bringing something of myself to these stories. I write a lot about trans men because there's not a lot of media about trans men.
Sure.
And I write a lot about rural communities because I'm both from one, I've chosen to move back to one. And I think stories of like queer and trans folks that choose to live in rural spaces are really fascinating to me. We don't talk about them enough. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing about that a lot. And then it's really been in the past couple of years that I've started to get into a space of trying to write for television, which I'm still like in the very, very beginning of that. It's like learning a whole new language of how to write. And then there's a lot more barriers to getting to TV stuff. Like if you write a play, you can just put up the play with your friends in any space. You can't just like make a TV show. So I'm still working on navigating that space, but I did the Humanitas Fellowship, which was really, really helpful. Got to be mentored by a TV showrunner and get feedback on a script. And so still working on those. Of course, now the writers are all on strike, so we are supporting them to get a fair deal and hoping that the studios get their shit together soon or else we're going to be watching reality television.
No, God, no.
Hating on reality television. That's my dopamine fix, y'all. I love some Married at First Sight and Love is Blind and The Ultimatum. Also, The Ultimatum Queer Love was a total hot mess and I was here for it.
No, I'm saying that is the only option that we'll have if the studios don't stop being
greedy. Need imaginative stories. We need other things. We can't have reality TV to be our only source. I will die.
I can't.
And I think that what you just said, right? The imaginative stories, like that is what I'm so passionate about because it's like we have to be able to
good theater.
Imagine something good... in order to inhabit it. And so like we have to have people writing stories that help us to envision new ways of being.
Absolutely.
And that help us to understand one another, right? Like there is no... It is not an accident that when Will and Grace, for all of its problems, but when Will and Grace became popular, the conversation about gay marriage in this country shifted. And it is like, we can point to that and say, it made an actual difference in the lives of people because this thing was on television and people who like didn't know that they knew gay people suddenly had a different understanding, right? It made a difference. Yeah. And Ellen coming out, right? Like made a difference.
Yes.
That's why I'm so like passionate about like, we need more trans stories and we need them now because it's still a very small percentage of people in the US that know a trans person or that think that know they know a trans person. And so stories really matter.
I agree.
Well, stories do matter, which is why we want to be able to send all of our listeners to anywhere that you're at and be able to get them to find your plays or get them to be able to find your book. So where can people find you, Shannon, online, in person, if you want to give your address? No, I'm just kidding. No, but like, where can people get in contact?
Long love letters.
Yeah. where can people get in contact with you? Where can they find your work?
So I'm on all of the social medias at Shannon TL Kearns. That is also my website, shannontlkearns.com. I am most active on Instagram. That's my jam, but I am on all of the socials. I do TikTok badly because I am an elder millennial or Gen Xer.
Because you have to, and there's no other choice. Exactly. You have to just do it.
Yes.
And we call it the TikTok.
I don't.
Often call it the Tiki Talkies because I'm that uncool. And then my work, a lot of my theological work is on queertheology.com. We also have social media. And the book can be found anywhere. I love it when people order from independent local bookstores, but you can also get it on the Behemoth, which shall not be named. And it is also on Audible with me reading it.
Yeah, sorry. I did order it on Audible.
No, so. It's great. I think that's like for small publishers, right? I think that's kind of the only place you can publish an audiobook. I don't know
where else you can. Audible's great. It is good because then I can listen to you while I'm driving, and you know, I also think it's super special to hear the author read the book to you. I just think it is. Well, thank you so much, Shannon. I don't have any more questions. Is there any... I'm a little bit curious about your playwright screenwriting. Is there anywhere that we can like find your work in that area? Or are you kind of just doing the thing?
So you can read more about it on my website. Okay. And then I post updates and stuff on social media. Okay. There aren't any places right now unless, so if this is like a niche playwriting thing, there's a website mm-hmm. called New Play Exchange. If you're on New Play Exchange, you can actually download and read some of my plays. But there isn't really a place to watch them right now. But hopefully, you know, I will say I am touring a solo performance piece called The Body's Rapture. So that is both available for groups to bring me to perform, but also I will be doing at some point. I know I'm going to be doing some in my region in the fall and in Michigan in October.
Are you coming to Kansas City at all?
I am working on it.
Cool, because I'm in Kansas City. So
nice. We are not far from one another.
We are not far.
I was actually just in Kansas City the other night.
Oh my God. I'm literally here. So
amazing.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah, I've been reaching out to a bunch of churches in Kansas City trying to see if anyone wants to bring it in. Right now, I'm gonna be in possibly in Manhattan, Kansas, which I think is a bit north.
It's a bit far.
Yeah.
I wonder if we could facilitate you here somewhere. I don't know. Maybe we'll talk.
Yeah.
That would be cool. Okay. Well, thank you all for listening to this fantastic episode with Shannon. And I hope you go and follow him on all of the socials and the TikTok. And thank you so much for being here, Shannon. And we love talking to you.
So. Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and your experience with us. We really appreciate it. And for answering our burning questions.
Yes.
Of course.
Other burning questions must be submitted to the Google.
The Google. You have no rights here.
Well, thank you. Have a great night.
All right. Bye. Bye.
Looking for a safe place to deconstruct? If so, I have the place for you. We have a Facebook support group, and if you're not in it, you should absolutely be in it because there's a lot of amazing conversations happening in this group. So if you are wanting to be in a community with others who are in the same deconstruction process, find us on Facebook, Cheers to Leaving Support Group. You can also click the link in our show notes and it will take you to that page. You can request to join, answer the questions, and become part of the conversation. We're looking forward to seeing you there.
Thanks for listening to Cheers to Leaving. We are seriously so glad you're here. Follow us on Instagram at Cheers to Leaving. Our sound and editing is by Cameron Smith. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe and share with your friends and others who may be deconstructing. You can also email us at cheerstoleaving@gmail.com with your stories about leaving evangelicalism. See you in 2 weeks.